Hello and good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for the second installment in a five-part series on employment compliance and government contracting. Today's program is going to focus on pay equity audits, which is a very timely topic given recent developments from the federal government, specifically the EEOC and the Department of Labor. My name is Matt Kissling, and I'm an associate in Thompson Hines Labor and Employment Practice Group, where I primarily focus on advising government contractors and subcontractors on a variety of aspects of their employment-related obligations under both federal, state, and local laws and regulations. Today's webinar is going to discuss the why, what, and how of conducting pay equity audits. This discussion is going to include a review of the current legal landscape for government contractors with respect to compensation, and then we'll move to providing an analysis of how you can conduct your own internal pay equity audit to really get out in front of a potential government review. Before we begin, I just want to have a few preliminary notes about the materials and the technology we're using today. Today's program is going to be recorded and will be available on Thompson Hines' website once we're done today. Questions will be addressed at the end of the program. And if you could please submit any questions using the question box that appears on your side panel, and then we will try to address them at the end of the program. If we're not able to address your question during the presentation today, then we'll certainly be sure to follow up with you directly via email over the next couple of days. Since we're lawyers, we do always do like to have a quick disclaimer that this presentation is intended to provide educational information about legal matters, and we do hope that you enjoy it, but it is not intended as legal advice and does not establish an attorney-client relationship with Thompson Hine or myself. You should certainly not act upon any information contained in this presentation without consulting legal counsel first. So I mentioned before that today's topic is about pay equity audits, and we're going to cover three different points. First, why is pay equity important? This is really going to cover the legal landscape surrounding compensation and audits of pay practices. I'm going to provide an overview of what exactly is a pay equity audit, go through the basics and the nuts and bolts of the audit process, and then finally include a discussion of how should an audit be conducted if you choose to do one internally. So from the overall legal standpoint, it starts with the federal law and the anti-discrimination laws. We're under Title VII. It is unlawful to discriminate against any individual with respect to compensation because of that person's protected characteristics. Now, Title VII was revised in 2009 by the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, where the 180 deadline for filing equal pay lawsuits reset with each new paycheck where pay disparities exist. So if there are issues with pay or disparities, each time a paycheck is issued, resets that statute of limitations for filing a lawsuit under Title VII. Similar to Title VII, the ADEA makes it unlawful to discriminate against someone with respect to compensation because of their age. Under the ADEA, it makes it unlawful to discriminate based on compensation because of disability. And then the Equal Pay Act requires pay equality for work performed by men and women in the same establishment, where employers generally must pay equal wages to both men and women who perform work requiring substantially equal skill, effort, and responsibility and under similar working conditions. And this applies really to any form of compensation, including base wages, overtime, bonuses, and other forms of incentive compensation. And I'll touch on what exactly EEOC has to say about equal skill, effort, and responsibility in a few moments. So according to the EEOC, compensation discrimination under each of these laws can occur in a variety of forms. You know, a few good examples are, first, when an employer pays an employee with a disability less than similarly situated employees without disabilities. That's a pretty clear-cut example of how compensation discrimination could arise. Another example is if an employer sets compensation for jobs that are predominantly held by a particular protected class below the level suggested by an external job evaluation study, which jobs are predominantly held by another class are at or above the suggested level from that external evaluation study. And then a third example would be where an employer has a neutral compensation policy, but it has an adverse impact unemployed in a particular protected class. And when presented with the issue, the employer cannot adequately explain why those disparities exist based on some sort of a job-related issue or otherwise consistent with business necessity. Now, in the EEOC compliance manual, they do provide an outline of kind of the factors they use to analyze what constitutes equal work whenever they look at an employer's compensation system. And from a skill perspective, they consider this to be measured by factors like the experience, ability, education, and training required to perform a particular job. And you must compare the skills required for the specific job at issue. From an effort perspective, they consider this to be the amount of physical or mental exertion required for the job. Responsibility is the degree of accountability required for performing the job. So whether an employee works without supervision or whether the employee themselves have supervisory responsibility over other workers. And then finally, they look at working conditions, which are the physical surroundings and the potential hazards in the workplace. Now, as I'm sure we've all heard over the past couple of months, the EEOC is back into its oversight efforts from an EEO1 reporting perspective, where currently summary pay reports are due on September 30th, 2019. This will require all private employers with at least 100 employees, or for our purposes, all government contractors or subcontractors with at least 50 employees, to report summary pay data and aggregated hours worked for employees along with the normal EEO1 data. Now, the normal EEO1 data was due last Friday on May 31st, unless you obtain the automatic two-week extension until June 14th. But by this September 30th, you're now also going to be required to provide both the hours worked and pay data for both 2018 and 2017, where the hours worked are considered to be the total number of hours worked in a year by all employees in each of the 12 salary bands, you know, that are going to be laid out by the EEOC. They've taken the position that for exempt employees, you can use a default 40-hour work week, but for non-exempt employees, you have to rely upon the actual number of hours worked per week in a year. Then from a pay data perspective, the new reports will require you to include the total number of full and part-time employees in each of your EEO1 categories, as well as in each of the 12 different salary bands. And with that kind of a breakdown, you'll need to report the total number of male and female employees within each salary band for that particular group who self-identify as Hispanic or Latino, which is, from a race ethnicity perspective, supersedes any additional classification that person may self-identify. And you also need to report the total number of male and female employees within each salary band for an EEO1 job group who self-identify as one of the other racial categories. And with that kind of a breakdown, here's a kind of a good example of what the form may look like. Employers will need to report the number of employees within each job group and within each salary band who fall within one of the categories of either gender or race or ethnicity. So it definitely adds a pretty complicated aspect to the EEO1 reporting process. And we fully expect that the EEOC will be using this data to proactively conduct a review of employer and contractor compensation information to determine whether any forms of disparities exist. Now, as if the EEOC and the EEO1 reporting wasn't enough of a problem, since we live in the unique world of government contracting, you also have to worry about the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, where they have made it clear for a number of years now that pay equity is a key area of focus for their compliance efforts and audits. And they really have four main focus areas. First is regulatory enforcement. Second is during a desk audit, what we call the item number 19, employee level compensation requests. The third is the OFCCP describing what they do with that kind of data and their directive 2018-05, which was issued last August. And then their final area of focus is their frequent habit of engaging in compensation interviews with individual managers from audited contractors. So from a regulatory enforcement perspective, I thought it would be helpful to provide you an example of an actual OFCCP request that we received in April of 2019, which was occurred during in the course of a fairly routine desk audit, where they sent a laundry list of supplemental requests that include this one, where they requested a narrative with supporting documentation of the contractor's most recent in-depth analysis of their compensation system to determine whether gender, race, or ethnicity-based pay disparities exist. And they asked that the response include the date of the analysis, who conducted it, the explanation of all factors considered, and the details of any adjustments at the contractor that were triggered by the analysis. So basically what they're asking, we're asking for here is kind of a hallmark pay equity audit. And they were seeking the documentation that the government contractor had actually conducted this type of an audit in recent history. And the reason they're able to ask for that documentation is this little provision in the federal regulations for governing affirmative action, where one of the requirements for a contractor's affirmative action program is an identification of problem areas, where the contractor is required to perform an in-depth analysis of its total employment process to determine whether and where impediments to equal opportunity exist. At a minimum, a contractor is required to evaluate its compensation systems to determine whether there are gender, race, or ethnicity-based disparities. So the bottom line here is that the regulations for affirmative action require contractors to conduct a periodic compensation audit. And we've now seen the OFCCP ask for documentation that this has occurred during the course of a compliance audit. Now, of course, the OFCCP is not going to wait for a contractor to conduct that self-audit. Instead, during a routine desk evaluation, the OFCCP is going to conduct its own review of a contractor's compensation. Yeah, if you've ever been audited by the government, you know that you receive a scheduling letter that contains a listing of 22 different types of information and documents to be submitted. And item number 19 of this letter focuses specifically on employee-level compensation at a particular facility that's being audited. And here's the quote-unquote language from the item number 19 request, where basically they request employee-level compensation data for all employees, both full-time, part-time, contract, per diem, day labor, and temporary employees. And they require a contractor to provide gender and race information for each employee, as well as the hire date for those individuals, job title, EEO-1 category, and job group in a single Excel spreadsheet. They also require contractors to provide information about base salary or wages, hours worked in a typical work week, and any other forms of compensation or adjustments to salary. So bonuses, incentives, commissions, and stuff like that needs to be provided. And they also invite a contractor to provide any additional data that would be helpful for purposes of the OFCCP's analysis, whether it's education, experience, or salary grades, bands, or ranges. And then they additionally encourage contractors to provide documentation of their current compensation policies and practices for them to consider whenever they're auditing this employee level data. So from a data perspective, the key points the OFCCP requires you to provide are the base wage rate, bonuses, and other forms of incentive compensation for all employees, typical hours worked per week, EEO self-identification data, an individual's hire date, job title, EEO-1 category. If you have a separate affirmative action plan job group to slot into, provide that, as well as information on any promotions that occurred for employees during the audit's review period. And again, some additional optional information that they encourage contractors to provide deal with education, experience, work locations, performance ratings, departments of job functions, salary levels, bands, ranges, or grades, and compensation policies. And then what the OFCCP has is also a catch-all, any other data or factors that are used to set employee compensation. So, you know, I mentioned before that a contractor is required to submit this information in connection with the desk audits. And the next question is, well, what is the OFCCP going to do with it? And in prior years, they were pretty cloak and dagger and relatively vague about what exactly they do with this type of compensation information. Under the new administration, they issued this directive 2018-05, and back in August, on August 24th, which really provides some more transparency and outlines their position on compensation discrimination and what they'll do with a contractor's data. The directive leads in with the general statement that pay discrimination by federal contractors is unlawful and reiterates the point that its elimination is a key enforcement priority of the OFCCP during any sort of a compliance audit. It really, their focus is on identifying and resolving compensation disparities through their compliance audits, you know, where there's evidence that disparities were the result of systemic discrimination, whether it's pattern or practice, disparate impact, or a combination of both. And so, again, what will the OFCCP do once they receive your data? They'll first develop what they call pay analysis groupings of comparable employees. And this really looks at job similarities, whether it's tasks performed, skills required, a level of authority, or other objective factors like certifications, education, or minimum qualifications. The OFCCP may go one step further and request that the contractor provide the actual pay analysis groupings with the understanding that the contractor has the better understanding of their individual job titles and their compensation system. And so they'll ask the contractor to provide the PAGs and then hold them accountable for the analyses that are then conducted on those groupings. Once the PAGs are provided, OFCCP is going to run a statistical analysis of the compensation paid within each grouping. They'll generally separately analyze both base pay and total compensation. They may look at other forms of compensation, whether it's bonuses, commissions, or overtime. And they may also ask for a specific breakout of the different types of bonuses that may be paid to employees, whether it's a holiday bonus, a discretionary or company performance bonus, or even an individual performance review bonus. Once they've run their analyses, they'll notify contractors of any preliminary disparities and seek additional information to try and explain those disparities. Or they may also request further information or even initiate an on-site review at the contractor's particular facility that's under audit. As part of these efforts, whether it's before or after conducting an analysis, the OFCCP may also ask to interview key officials who are involved with compensation at a contractor. And really the primary targets are human resources and whoever the contractor considers to be the chief compensation official for that particular establishment. And there are really a number of goals that the OFCCP is trying to establish. First, they may be trying to determine specifically how to group employees for their statistical analysis. They may be seeking clarification on what forms and compensation should be reviewed and what factors are relevant for pay. And they may also be trying to gain a better understanding of how compensation determinations are made. Whenever one of these interviews is scheduled, it's typically conducted over the phone, and after the interview, the official is required to review and then sign a handwritten or typed interview statement from the OFCCP compliance officer, and then that goes into the formal file for that compliance audit. So once they've gone through this process and conducted their analyses, the OFCCP may issue a predetermination notice if they identify disparities and make preliminary discrimination findings. You know, typically then a contractor will have an opportunity to provide a non-discriminatory reason for any compensation disparities that exist. And ultimately the OFCCP is going to determine during the audit if there is evidence of compensation discrimination, and they will then attempt to resolve it through either a conciliation process or pursuing an enforcement action before the Department of Labor's Office of Administrative Law judges. So some of you who may have attended the first installment of this webinar may recall this slide, which outlines the basic consequences of discrimination according to the OFCCP. And the typical starting point for addressing these issues is the OFCCP will try to enter into a conciliation agreement with the contractor, which is typically effective for at least 2 years and will automatically trigger a follow-up compliance audit at some point after the conciliation agreement expires. And these types of agreements may also require payment, certain monetary payments or submission of progress reports to the Department of Labor. In connection with these agreements or an enforcement action, the OFCCP does love to release what we call public shaming press releases, where they announce the specific issues that were identified and the resolution that was released. They don't consider that to be confidential. If conciliation cannot be achieved, then the next step would be to file an administrative complaint with an administrative law judge and go through the enforcement action process. And that could also, again, result in payment of back wages, as well as an order from the ALJ requiring withholding of progress payments on the contractor's government contracts, or even leading to eventual contract cancellation or debarment if there are egregious issues identified or if the contractor is completely unwilling to cooperate. So a few good recent examples of kind of the cost of pay disparities in contracting are going all the way back to October of 2017. More recently, last fall, Avian's Food up in, I believe, Minnesota was required to pay almost $400,000 in back pay for gender pay discrimination that was identified during an audit. Dell was required to pay $2.9 million in back pay for both gender and race pay discrimination. Humana, in March of last year, agreed to pay $2.5 million in back pay for gender pay discrimination at the company's headquarters. And then in October of 2017, State Street Bank was required to pay $5 million in back pay for gender and race pay discrimination that, again, was uncovered during a routine compliance audit. In terms of ongoing enforcement actions, OFCCP is currently in a titanic battle with Oracle over compensation discrimination issues, where they recently filed an amended complaint in January and are now alleging that Oracle owes about $400 million in back pay for paying females and minorities less and then also steering them towards lower level positions. And it's currently set for a formal hearing in December of this year before an administrative law judge in San Francisco. As part of the process, Oracle has actually been required to provide historical compensation data going back all the way to 1985 for every employee who has worked in certain categories for the company between January 1st of 2013 and January 18th of 2019, which was right before the amended complaint was filed in the case. So this is a good example of kind of the worst case scenario for a contractor if pay equity issues are identified during a compliance audit. So really, kind of highlights the importance of trying to jump out in front of a potential government review of your pay data and conducting your own self-audit of your pay practices. So that really leads us to kind of the second portion of our discussion today, and is what exactly is a pay equity audit? You know, it's always helpful to start with, okay, what are the discussion of what are the potential causes, you know, for pay disparities at your company? It could be as simple as failing to follow a written compensation policy, which could be addressed with training for individuals who are responsible for establishing pay. It could also be an inconsistent application of pay practices, you know, such as relying on certifications for one job title, but not another. Again, you have a neutral pay practice in place, but it's not being consistently applied across the board. It could involve grouping dissimilar employees into the same job grouping. You know, a good example would be, you know, if employees in the same grouping have wages ranging from $50,000 up to $120,000, are they really similar? You know, another example would be grouping executive level employees together with lower level management or professional employees with production level employees. You know, that could lead to some pretty clear-cut compensation discrimination issues or compensation disparity issues, just based on the clear differences in the type of work being performed and the associated pay levels for each of those jobs. Another issue that could cause disparities is a reliance on overly large pay ranges or scales for positions. This will typically mask potential problems in your system. It can also involve strength of individual employee negotiations in the compensation process, or from a related perspective, allowing too much subjectivity when setting compensation, and allowing managers too much leeway in terms of how they assign starting pay or pay increases to employees. And then it could even result from using the employer's prior salary and then giving them a bump without any sort of further evaluation of, you know, whether that bump is appropriate or in line with how other employees are being paid. And again, that, you know, really kind of highlights the importance of, you know, why contractors should get out in front of the issue and determine whether any of these issues exist. And that's really what the purpose of a pay equity audit is. It's designed to provide you an understanding of whether your compensation is, an employer's compensation is influenced by, you know, what we expect to be the permissible factors that influence compensation, such as type of job or the skills involved, or if they're being influenced by more impermissible factors, such as gender, age, race, or another protected characteristic. These audits can also help reveal trends across job groupings and even position-specific issues. So some questions to ask are, whose pay is being compared? You know, what pay differences are at issue? You know, what are the factors that can explain the pay differences? Is there additional investigation needed? And at the end of the audit, are there any remedial steps required to address disparities that are identified? So any type of effective audit really has a number of different steps or stages. And this really starts with identifying your goals and establishing attorney-client privilege. And during this initial process, the idea here is to identify what are the key goals and the objectives of the audit. You know, you also want to define the specific scope of the analysis, including the, in the particular workforce or the subcomponent of that workforce, and to be reviewed, and then the types of pay to analyze. You want to identify who to include on your audit team, and then you also want to implement protocols to preserve attorney-client privilege, as well as attorney work product protections. Then really the next step in the process is to obtain initial information for the audit. And this involves a first discussion with your full audit team, where again, you reiterate what the scope and the purpose of the audit is. Then you then want to obtain information about your organization's compensation structure and policies, you know, pay philosophies, and then identify job-related factors and drivers of employee pay. So this really forms the backbone of the audit. And this is looking at, you know, your on-paper compensation policies and practices, because those will help you identify what are the factors and issues that we need to look at in the coming audit and statistical analysis. And it'll also help you determine, you know, what is really the best way to group employees together for purposes of the statistical analysis. In other words, the appropriate pay analysis groups for individual positions. So when you're at that step one of the process and you're defining the scopes, the goals and the scope, you know, the first question to ask is, you know, what are you hoping to accomplish with the audit? Are you seeking to mitigate risk? You know, address potential problem areas? Have you been audited by the OFCCP and want to know, you know, what their potential findings will be? The next question is, you know, what do you want to analyze? Do you want to look at total compensation, or do you want to look at base salary, or another particular component of compensation? You know, who do you want to analyze? Is it your entire U.S. workforce? Is your workers in a specific state, or your workers at a specific location or particular function? And this more narrow category of a particular location is, you know, typically what we see, you know, whenever an OFCCP audit commences, because it's looking at one particular physical location of a contractor. And so their review of compensation will be limited solely to that particular facility. And then again, when to begin the audit? Is it before or after scheduled pay adjustments? Do you, you know, conduct an annual compensation review or an annual period of time, such as April 1st, when pay adjustments are made? That might be a good time to commence the audit. Another example would be, again, if you're under an OFCCP audit, you know, what was the snapshot date of the other data that you provided to the government for the affirmative action plan? Was it December 31st of the prior year? If so, that could be the good kind of snapshot date for when you look at employee level compensation in your audit. again, the other key aspect of the first step is to, who should you involve? It's always a great idea to involve legal counsel, whether internal legal counsel or external legal counsel. And this is essential to preserve the attorney-client privilege of the pay equity audit that's undertaken. Going back to that April 2019 request that we received from an OFCCP compliance officer, the contractor there was able to refuse to provide the requested documentation of their internal pay equity audit because they had it conducted by outside legal counsel, and therefore it was protected by the attorney-client privilege and the work product doctrine. And so the response was that simply it was privileged material, and there's really nothing the OFCCP can do about it because their investigation does not supersede a contractor's right to assert the attorney-client privilege over that type of documentation. So legal counsel should absolutely always be involved in a pay equity audit. Other folks to involve are your compensation leadership. Who are the individuals primarily responsible for setting compensation policies and practices and ultimately helping make compensation determinations for employees? Human resources leadership, again, they may be involved in the compensation process. They may also be able to speak to the organization's other employment-related policies that may be relevant to compensation, such as performance reviews or disciplinary policies and stuff like that. Since you're going to be pulling a specific employee data for an audit, if you have HRIS staff or other IS personnel who help manage your employee data, it's important to involve someone there because they're going to be the ones who know how to pull the data out of your system and be able to assist in the audit and analysis component. And again, if it becomes necessary, you can even involve a labor statistician who is really a professional expert for looking at these types of data statistics. And this really depends on the complexity of the data you're looking with, as well as really how deep you want to dive going into the pay equity audit. So once you get outside these first two steps, really the next big step of a pay equity audit is to gather and conduct an initial analysis of the data required for the audit. And this is really where you partner with your HRIS staff to gather the employee level data for each person who's going to be analyzed. And this is important to make sure that this data includes pay information, job title, job department, date of hire, performance data, and really any other relevant factors that you've identified during an earlier step two portion of the audit. And you also want to make sure you take an initial review of the employee data to make sure there aren't any discrepancies or deficiencies in the data that's been pulled out of the system, because you won't be able to conduct an effective audit unless the data is accurate and complete. And once you've gotten all that data together and everything looks good, the next step is to conduct some preliminary statistical analysis of the compensation data. Again, this is analyzed by the pay analysis groupings that you've previously identified, and also accounts for those primary relevant factors that you've pinpointed that are expected to influence compensation for individual employees. And then once you've conducted those initial analyses, the goal is to review the results and see if there are any groupings that have potential red flags or areas of concern that may require further review, or where you may want to take that deeper dive to get to the root of any potential disparities that exist. So I've mentioned these pay analysis groupings several times so far. And there are really a number of different type of groupings that you can make. And we really see it as a funneling process. It can start, from the broadest possible grouping, what we call the pooled analysis, where you have a single pay analysis grouping for all employees being analyzed. It can get a little more narrow if you break it out by location. So if you have employees at five different locations who are part of the audit, breaking them out into their specific geographic location could be a way to undertake the review. Another option is to break them out by your affirmative action plan or EEO-1 job groups, such as craft workers or sales workers or professional level employees. Again, this narrows down the groupings a bit. You can even combine it with location, break it out by EEO-1 job group and by location. And the downside to that is not every position in a particular job group, such as craft workers, really may be similar in function or pay scale. So that is just something to keep in mind, if you decide to group it that way. Another way to group would be if you have wage grades for particular positions, grouping individual employees by the particular wage grade that is assigned to the position. You could also narrow it down even further through a department or job family, or what we call job title clusters. And really, the job title clusters are looking at individual positions and determining which positions are similar to each other in both function as well as potential pay scale, and then grouping those titles accordingly. And you can even go as narrow as individual job title or job code. The downside there is that it may be too narrow for a meaningful analysis to be conducted. If you have, let's say, for a particular position, only one person holds that position, that's really not going to provide you a meaningful statistical analysis to see whether that individual may be paid less than people in other comparable positions. So really getting it down to the department or job family or the job title clusters are, from generally speaking, the best ways to group individual employees for conducting an analysis. And again, once you group these folks together, that's when you conduct those initial statistical analyses to see whether any initial disparities exist. If they do, then it's really time to take a deeper dive. And for any hotspot areas of concerns or red flags, it's then time to perform a more in-depth review of all of the factors that would be expected to drive pay differences within the grouping. And this can also be the time when you resolve any data issues that may arise during the analysis. When you've conducted an analysis, you determine that employees are slotted into a wrong job group or level, or maybe they really didn't belong in the pay analysis grouping that you placed them into and they should be moved elsewhere. And you can also, again, break down the analysis further and look at the individual components of a pay analysis group. So then run an analysis based on individual positions or job title groups, as well as other relevant factors that could influence compensation. Now, at the end of the day, after this deeper dive, there's still disparities that exist, and you just really can't, reach an explanation as to why they exist. That's really the time when you reach the end of the audit and you need to consider remedial efforts. And again, these efforts could include pay adjustments or reclassification of employee levels or job titles. If needed, you could also explore potential modifications to policies, procedures, or practices related to compensation, or conduct training to make sure that compensation policies are being appropriately applied. And then, finally, you would want to schedule a follow-up pay audit to measure your success and as well as monitor your ongoing of compliance. And again, being mindful of what, as a government contractor, the regulations require, and that's to conduct periodic audits of your compensation systems, whether it's on an annual basis, biannual, or even every 5 years. It's really up to you there, but the requirement is to conduct a periodic audit and then make any sort of necessary adjustments to the system. So I've already touched upon this before, but whenever you identify those initial hotspots, it's time to dive into the reasons for the disparities. And there are a number of reasons why a difference could exist. This could be unique expertise of an individual prior to joining your company. Are there special skills, certifications, or education that a particular person possesses that their comparators do not? Is there a premium paid for a highly qualified new hire? So again, that goes back to kind of the salary negotiation process. Are there certain performance-related factors? Does one person have consistently high ratings while another person has consistently low ratings? Have there been internal promotions or career progression or moves up in step? Could there be a cost of living adjustment due to a transfer from a different geographic location? Or was someone demoted, or is their compensation frozen because of a performance improvement plan or some other form of discipline over the past year? Again, really the takeaway, for this portion of the audit is to conduct additional research and analysis and to really determine why their pay disparities may exist and, to identify, if possible, legitimate business justification for those pay differences in the workplace. And then again, I've already touched upon this, but a number of different remediation considerations it may come into play at the conclusion of the audit. And really, the key things to remember here is who needs to receive a pay adjustment? Is there a monetary limit to the adjustment? How should they be calculated? When will they occur? Is it a standalone one-time adjustment, or is it should it be in line with your organization's normal compensation reviews or pay adjustments? Really, the key thing to remember here is that any adjustments due to disparities can be upward only. It's never a good idea to decrease other employees' salaries in order to achieve equity amongst comparators. The solution here is to, if you identify someone who's paid less, adjust their compensation upwards. Don't do the opposite and bring everyone else down in terms of pay, because that could lead to a number of other issues moving forward from an employee relations perspective. Again, I mentioned this before, policy adjustments. You may want to reassess your compensation policies or commissions or bonuses or other supplemental compensation practices. Undertaking a review of starting pay practices. Is there a particular formula or analysis that's used to calculate starting pay? Look at the job descriptions. Are they, accurately reflective of the position at issue? And do they accurately capture what's specifically required for the job or what qualifications are preferred for a job that may lead to a higher starting salary? And go the same thing with a promotion policy. And what's the particular specific requirements for promotions? And if someone's promoted, are they going to be receiving some sort of a compensation increase? And then again, the final component is to put a date on the books to conduct a follow-up audit. Establish that internal clock within your organization. Again, there's no set specific time requirement, as long as it would arguably meet the periodic audit requirement that's set forth in the regulations. So that's really those are really the nuts and bolts of a pay equity audit. And so that's really what I conclude this webinar today by briefly discussing how can you or how should you conduct a pay equity audit for your organization if you're interested in doing so. And again, it starts with what are your goals here? What's your organization's area of concern? Have issues already been identified? Are you being identified slated for an audit, or is there something else that's driving the need to conduct the audit? So the key starting point is what specifically are you concerned about? And again, you should always ask who and what to analyze. Is it your entire workforce, or is it a particular location or a particular job title? What type of compensation do you want to look at? What are the potential pay analysis groupings that you want to use for the audit? What are the factors that you would expect to influence compensation decisions at in your organization? Is it seniority, time and job, specific job title, or something else? And who are the key people to involve? And when do you want to begin the audit, and what is your time frame for completion? This is certainly not a process that needs to all take place all in 1 week. These types of audits take time. So if it's a several month process, that's perfectly acceptable, because you want to make sure that the audit is conducted thoroughly and you have the best resources available to conduct an effective pay equity audit. Next step is to gather your employee data. And again, at a minimum, you want to look at employee pull employee IDs, the sex and race or ethnicity for each individual employee, their job title, their employee type, whether it's full-time or part-time, as well as their exemption status. Because for some organizations, full-time versus part-time or exempt versus non-exempt may drive the level of compensation. You want to pull department. That might be a way to break employees out, or may help you pinpoint who you need to talk to if disparities are identified. Your EEO-1 job group, again, that provides another option for breaking out the analysis. And also, as of September 30th, that's how pay compensation will be reported to the EEOC as part of the new reporting requirements. Again, you want pull base pay as well as base type, whether it's annual or hourly. Wage grades, if you assign wage grades or salary bands to employees. An employee's original hire date, and then an employee's current job entry date, because those are both things that could be determinative of how much an employee is paid. And once you've pulled that data, the next step is to form your pay analysis groups. And whenever we put these types of groupings together, it's really based on two types of similarity or two factors. First is what we call functional similarity. And these are, individual positions grouped together based on job functions, department family, and skills and similarities in each of those areas. And then the second factor is what we call pay factor similarity, where the question you're asking here is, do you apply a same or a substantially similar pay model to each position within the pay analysis grouping? And this approach, from both a functional and pay factor similarity perspective, is most closely aligned with what the OFCCP considers to be appropriate, as well as what the equal pay requirements under a number of state laws require. So from a functional similarity perspective, whenever you're trying to group employees together, just really have a few pointers here. First, you always want to separate full-time employees from part-time employees, because when you run an analysis and you have a part-time employee, you would expect that their annualized wages are going to be less than a full-time equivalent. And so if you don't separate them out, that could essentially create a false positive and create a red flag in the analysis that may not actually be there. So again, going back to the similarities, full-time and part-time are different, and you want to analyze them separately from each other. You can also exclude interns and temporary employees from the analysis, because again, their compensation structure may be drastically different from how other full-time regular employees are paid. And a few other things to consider, again, are what are the specific job titles, functions, and job duties? So if folks have similar job titles, do we expect them to be similar in function? Levels of responsibility as well as organizational roles. So a good example there would be, do you really want to group directors and mid-level managers together, or managers and supervisors together? And so it's really looking at what's a particular position's level of responsibility and their role within the overall organization, because that could determine who they should be considered similar to from a function perspective. Another thing to consider is the department, division, or business unit. Are positions within a particular business unit or department generally similar in the function that they're performing? So if they're in the operations department, they're serving in an operator role. Are they all at the end of the day performing operation roles within the organization? Same with engineering. You may have mechanical, electrical, hydraulic engineers. At the end of the day, they're all engineers. But can you say that they are functionally similar in their day-to-day job duties? That might be a good way to look at it. And again, commonality of supervisors or managers, that kind of goes part and parcel with the department. One supervisor may, have a particular process or method that they use for determining pay, and you certainly wouldn't want to compare them against another supervisor who may have a different policy in place. This could also identify, individuals you may need to speak to or provide additional training to make sure that they are appropriately applying your organization's compensation policies whenever they're setting pay for individual employees. So from a pay factor similarity perspective, again, this is looking to determine if the same or similar pay model is applied to the job titles in a potential grouping. Are neutral pay factors common or similar across, the job titles in the proposed grouping? So, is an individual's job entry date, an influencer for compensation for each of the positions within the grouping, or there's, their overall seniority, or their performance ratings, or their, potential promotion? That's really what it's geared towards here. And then also, do these factors have that similar influence on pay for all of those job titles? Another way to look at it is, are each of the positions within a particular grouping assigned the same or similar wage grade? If the answer is yes, that's a pretty good indicator that they're going to be, pretty similar from a pay factor perspective, and as a result, that makes their groupings together appropriate for purposes of the analysis. When you undertake this assessment, if you find that folks are not similar in terms of pay factors, then you may wish to modify a pay analysis group and then try to regroup to recreate the closest matches possible, or to create two subgroups within a particular grouping, and to account for those similarities or differences in pay models. So the next step, after you put together your groupings, is really to dive into the statistical component of the analysis. And there are really several different analyses that we recommend conducting. The first is what we call the OFCCP's item 11 test. And this was really the baseline statistical analysis under the OFCCP's old version of its scheduling letter. And what it really looks at here is, total compensation for protected sex and race or ethnicity categories within a particular pay analysis grouping. The thing to note here is that this analysis is no longer conducted by the OFCCP, but it can still be a helpful starting point for your own internal analysis to really get a clear initial picture of any broad potential disparities for a protected class, or just get it kind of a general lay of the land as to what your compensation practices look like. The next step in the process, and this is something the OFCCP still conducts, is what we call a first pass analysis. And this looks at if there's a difference of at least 2% or $2,000 in average pay between two protected classes, such as minorities versus non-minorities. And it's also conducted for each individual race and ethnic category compared against each other. So African Americans versus non-African Americans. And if a particular pay analysis group fails any portion of the first pass test, then that's a good indicator that additional statistical analysis or a deeper dive, is going to be required. And that leads to everyone's favorite topic, regression analysis, this incorporates those neutral factors or variables that you previously identified that are expected to influence employee compensation. And what the regression analysis is designed to do is to show whether those neutral factors actually predict differences in compensation within a particular group. This is essentially a statistical test of a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for any sort of a pay difference. And the question here is, as an example, are employees with higher levels of experience actually paid more than less experienced employees? If the answer is no, that could be an indicator that a deeper dive is required to look at other factors that may more effectively or truly impact employee compensation. Again, if there are any sort of unexplained disparities after those regression analyses, the next step would be to take that deeper dive and look at additional factors that could account for pay gaps. So, from an experience perspective, is it a rehire date, a seniority date, or an individual's date in their most recent graded position? From a performance perspective, look at your previous 3 years of performance ratings. Did someone consistently have low or high performance ratings? That could be a driver of compensation differences. Highest level of education received, that could have been something that was taken into account, or years of prior work experience. From a general job information perspective, what shift does somebody work? Are there shift differentials applied for someone working first shift versus third shift? And what's that person's level of responsibility? Are they a lead or are they a supervisor? And then, even external market data, such as minimums, midpoints, or maximums, are these things that are considered whenever setting employee compensation? If so, plug them and back into the regression analysis to see if they explain away the pay disparities that exist. And then even from the broad perspective, your organizational structure, if you haven't already analyzed these factors, look at your departments or wage grades or subgrades, because again, those could be legitimate factors that would explain the disparities that exist whenever you conduct a regression analysis. So really the deeper dive is looking at these additional factors, plugging them back into the regression analysis, and running it and seeing if that explains away the potential differences. And if not, then that's really the time when you may want to consider additional responsive actions, to try and correct those disparities, in compensation. And again, some things that may need to be considered are pay adjustments for affected employees, reclassification of job titles or salary grades, modification of policies or practices, or even training for compensation officials and decision makers to make sure that they're consistently and appropriately applying your organization's compensation practices. And at the end of the day, you know, what, if you make these types of changes, or even if nothing was identified, it's always a good idea to schedule a follow-up audit and to make sure that you're measuring the success of your efforts on a periodic basis. So this is obviously a pretty intensive process, but I think, you know, the kind of the legal landscape we reviewed earlier, it really highlights the importance that if you conduct this type of proactive internal audit, you can really jump out in front of, you know, a potential government review of your compensation practices, as well as be able to proactively, you know, identify issues and take appropriate remedial action to put yourself in the best place possible to not only, you know, eliminate or reduce pay disparities in the workplace, but also prepare yourself in the event that you're audited by the federal government. So that's, I know it's a lot of material here today, but I just wanted to take an opportunity to answer any questions that anyone may have. I currently don't see any questions in the comment box, but if you have any questions at this point, you know, please feel free to ask them and I can respond to them as well. If there aren't, if you don't have any questions at this point, or but something comes up down the road, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out to me or anyone else at Thompson Hine to get those answered for you. So I just wanted to thank you all for joining this discussion today. I wanted to let you know that the third installment of this 5-part webinar will take place on July 18th of 2019. That's a Thursday. And it's really what we're going to talk about there is a mid-year compliance check, as well as provide some best practices for responding to employment-related audits from the federal government. You know, and in the meantime, if you have any comments or questions, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out to me, and I will get back to you as soon as possible. So I'd just like to thank each and every one of you for attending today, and I hope everyone has a wonderful afternoon.